This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 94-year-old Chester Chet Thomason of Lemon Grove, California, originally from Porterville, California, which is a lot closer to Lemon Cove than Lemon Grove. We're going to hear about the exhilarating and emotional adventure he had this year in that part of the state. But for now, let's go back 75 years to 1942. With this young electrician's mate aboard the destroyer USS Monson. We heard how that ship engaged German U-boats in the Atlantic before America had ever entered World War II, and how it escorted the USS Hornet on the historic Doolittle raid on Tokyo. Little did Chet know at the time that his ship's days were numbered, that it would be sunk a mere 7 months later. So we have an understanding here, Chet. Tell us where your duty station was on that ship. When General Quarters sounded, where did you have to be?
After string, I had to make sure that rudder was operating right.
And that's above deck or below deck?
Below, way below deck.
And the implication of that is if you guys get hit, tough luck for you, huh?
Yep. You better learn to swim real fast. Of course, I was a good swimmer anyhow. I could hold my breath for 3 minutes. I'd practiced that many times.
Did the idea of being down there bother you at all?
No. It was a station, but I prepared myself for it.
I don't want to leave anything out, but I want to make sure that we get the whole story of the day the Monson was sunk off of Guadalcanal, November 13th, 1942. What do you remember about that day?
Friday the 13th.
You're not superstitious, are you?
Might say it. Friday the 13th, I figured out my lucky day.
Well, I guess you can look at different parts of that day and say it was both lucky and unlucky.
Yep, I lived through it, so my lucky day.
Well, you guys got torpedoed.
Right.
In the middle of the night.
Right.
Where were you when that happened?
I was in my bunk.
Well, that'll wake you up.
You're right. Prepare to abandon ship. I saw a 10-foot 4x4 out there. And I told the other guys that were with me, there was three guys. I was just making for that log, for that 4x4. That's what we did.
So you jumped in and you swam for the 4x4?
Right.
And you made it?
Right.
How long did you end up being in the water?
I think 14 hours.
14 hours in the water?
Yeah. I had one shark come up to take a bite of me, and I saw his teeth. I took both feet and kicked him out in the side of the face and left me alone.
And you were all alone at that point?
Right.
So you guys are floating on this 4x4, and you see sharks in the water.
Yep.
What does that do to you? I think most people would be scared out of their minds.
Well, I had Navy shoes on, so I drew back and my both feet and I kicked him in the side of the face.
Mm-hmm. What's going through your mind for 14 hours in the water?
I don't know. Don't remember.
Did you think you were going to die?
Nope.
Why not?
I was too young and invincible. My body was invincible.
Your ship wasn't.
Well, I was.
Did you see your ship go under?
Yep. It was on fire. Burning.
You're one of the last guys left from that ship. How do you think the guys who died that night should be remembered? What should people know about who they were and the kind of guys they were?
There was somebody's son, and somebody will say, well, I had a son that died in the war.
How do you explain the fact that you weren't one of them, that you survived all of this?
I just was the lucky ones.
About 25 years ago, they found your ship at the bottom of Iron Bottom Sound.
Uh-huh.
And I bet there's some stuff that belongs to you that's still on that ship.
Typewriter.
Typewriter?
Yep.
Then your locker?
Yep.
So if they go back down to it and explore a little, you want them to bring up your typewriter?
Would be much good now. I put in a chit to the Navy that they owed me for my typewriter.
What'd they say?
They still got it.
I know you can laugh about this now because you survived it, but 14 hours in the water, you've got nothing to eat, nothing to drink, right?
Right.
There's sharks going around.
Right.
As you can tell at home, some of the details of that ordeal weren't coming to the surface for Chet quite as readily as they have in the past, or when they did, they stirred up too many emotions for him to continue. But since he took the time years ago to write out an account to share with fellow Monson survivors, I can read for you a brief excerpt of that to help add to the picture of this intense experience on November 13, 1942. It was just after 3 a.m. when he spotted that 4x4 you heard him mention. "We all went over the side at the same time," Chet writes, "and made for the piece of wood. My Bulova watch stopped at 0313 in the water. When we were about 1/4 to 1/3 of a mile away from the ship, we could still see the big blaze and hear loud cries of pain and suffering coming from the ship. Just before daybreak, we heard a plane flying low over the water towards us. It sounded like one of ours, so I took my flashlight and flashed 3 dots, 3 dashes, 3 dots, SOS. He dipped his wings back and forth to acknowledge us and kept going. When it was daylight, 3 tall shark fins started circling. Story, Spurgeon, and Hughes didn't want any part of them. They said they would rather be blown up with the ship than eaten by sharks, so they started back for the ship. At about 10 o'clock, I caught up with a raft and whaleboat that were carrying a few of our men and some other men that I didn't know. One of them was one of our officers. He had his guts hanging out of his stomach. He could barely talk, but he told me that he had to go to the bathroom. I told him to go ahead and go. He said he couldn't with all those men around, so I took him out away from the raft about 20 feet and helped him. When he said he was through, I took him back to the raft, and he was dead within 10 or 15 minutes. At about 3 o'clock that afternoon, we were about a mile from the beach when a Higgins boat from Guadalcanal came up and asked us where we were going. We told him that we were headed for the beach. He told us that it wasn't our beach, it was the Japanese beach. So we climbed in and he took us and some other survivors to Guadalcanal. We stayed on Guadalcanal for 13 days. There were 19 of us able-bodied men off the USS Monson, out of 256. We left Guadalcanal on Thanksgiving Day. What contrast from dirty trenches to the USS Barnett, a transport with turkey, baths, bunks, and good food. There are so many twists and turns there, so many questions I'd love to ask, so many what ifs. And I know, again, that Chet, some of it you're just not up to getting into now, but I bet you can tell me what it felt like after 14 hours in the water to be saved from what would have been a very different future had you ended up on a Japanese beach and to be picked up by some friendly Americans.
Felt pretty good.
You had to have been exhausted by then.
Well, I didn't feel like running a 100-yard race.
No doubt. And that written account is very thorough. I have it linked at hometownheroesradio.com for anyone who would like to take the time to read it. We're going to hear soon about the most recent adventure Chet had, returning to Crystal Cave after 77 years and finding evidence of the work he had done there. But you've also lived a pretty colorful life in the interim. And in addition to working as an electrical contractor, you found another way to make your mark.
I was a hypnotherapist. I used to charge $65 for somebody to stop smoking or whatever they needed.
Did it work?
Sure. I stopped thousands of people from stopping smoking.
What's your answer for the people who think that's all made up or pretend or some kind of racket?
That's up to them. They want to spend their $65. They can believe it or not believe it by the results.
And I imagine you probably had a few famous names catch your act from time to time.
Oh, yeah. I was world-renowned.
Even the Duke caught your show? John Wayne?
Yep.
What did he say, partner?
How much you charge for a show? I says, $150. Too cheap, too cheap, too cheap.
His show business, I told you were worth more than that, huh?
Yep.
I could see why you'd get a kick out of that. Was there a trick that you used to do in your show that you were the most proud of, or was it kind of your signature deal?
Yes.
What's that?
Triple catalepsy. I take the smallest females and stack them up 3 at a time, and then I'd stand in the middle of them.
Yeah, you've got a picture in your brochure right now. So you've got one woman lying across 2 chairs, another woman lying across 2 chairs opposite, and then like an H, another woman is the connector between those two.
Right.
And you're standing with both feet on top of her.
Right. Then I'd stand on top of her and I'd say, 165 pounds, Sometimes I would get a standing ovation. I'd always get a big hand.
People thought it wasn't possible, probably, for her weight to sustain yours?
Right.
So what's the trick?
They're hypnotized.
So you're not going to pull back the veil for us and tell us what really happens?
I really did it.
And what can you tell me about these football players that carried you down to the cave?
They was pretty strong guys. They put me in a wheelchair. Away they go.
Pretty good ride, huh?
Right.
How'd that make you feel?
Pretty good.
What did it mean to you that your son would go to all this trouble to fly out here to find a football team to carry you down so you could see that cave one more time?
It's damned important.
Pretty good Father's Day present, huh?
Right.
Well, and if Chet's description of that return to Crystal Cave left us wanting more, we have plenty of voices to fill in some of the blanks. In a bit, we're going to hear from some of the football players who carried him down there. But first, let's hear from Chet's son, Corey, who hatched this creative plan. What was it like growing up with this guy as a dad? When did you first realize what he'd been through in the Navy?
A lot of the stories, you know, I've heard since I was hanging on his leg as a kid, you know. And the war was only 10 years back and when I was growing up. And he talks about it more now or a few years ago than he did when I was growing up because the experiences were fresher and more frightening.
But you heard, when you were a child, you heard that he survived the sinking of his ship and was in the water for 14 hours?
Yes, he was in that water and that they got him on the beach there at Guadalcanal. And he said, I'm a sailor. And they said, this is your foxhole and this is an M1 and stay there till somebody comes to get you. And because he was there for 14 days, he is considered a Guadalcanal survivor. And whenever the Guadalcanal survivors have a reunion, he is just about the only sailor that shows up. That herd's getting a little thin now. Took him down to a reunion for the Guadalcanal survivors a few years back. And he's got this little special vest that he had made that marks his naval time, his naval time, the battles he was at, Coral Sea, etc. We had a little wheelchair that we were pushing him around. It was kind of a walker type thing. And we'd go into a restaurant or a bar and there in New Orleans. And, you know, it's New Orleans. You got to have a mint julep. Pretty soon somebody come over and say, sir, your cocktail's on that guy over there. Or we go to a restaurant for a jumbo and sir, your dinner's on that guy over there. And he was quite proud of his service. It was a pretty interesting time to get together with all those survivors that went through Guadalcanal. The thing that most strikes me is, you know, he got to Guadalcanal and they needed bodies because they were running, the Marines were not being supplied as well as they should have been. And yeah, they needed bodies to support the defense of the headquarters. And that wound up being my father's job as secondary perimeter with an M1. And remember, he took his basic training with a Springfield. So he had to learn, he knew how to work sights. He just had to learn how to operate the rest of it.
You ever sit here and think, man, if he didn't survive the sinking of his ship, 14 hours in the water, the sharks, the enemy bullets and bombs and torpedoes and everything from all that time, you would have never been born?
I would have never. Yep, that's quite true. If he'd been at the wrong place at the wrong time, there was more than half the ship was killed when it went down, more than half the sailors and officers.
What's the most incredible part of that story to you?
The most incredible part is the long time in the water. Everybody's familiar with, or should be familiar with, the Indianapolis that carried the A-bomb, and it was sunk on the way back, and it was such a secret mission, and they had to fight the sharks, etc.
Worst shark attack in recorded history.
Yes, and yeah. The Navy taught him to scuba dive somewhere along the line, because there are pictures of him in Navy gear scuba, and he later on taught my brother and I both to scuba dive. He was the president of Desert Divers, which is a Mojave Desert scuba diving team. This is back in the mid-60s, and the whole crew would wind up going to Ensenada for a diving vacation. He'd go diving with his buddies, but he'd save one dive for my brother and I, and then one dive for my brother, and one dive for me. We had some great times with that. Has he ever hypnotized a member of his family? Yes, I have been hypnotized by him many times. I can't watch one of his shows for getting hypnotized. I came through on my way to Vietnam from Germany, and this was 1970. On my 30-day leave, he instructed me over and over again on self-hypnosis that in the event I were to be captured, I could rely on the self-hypnosis as a pain relief. Luckily, that didn't come about, but it was nice to have it in your back pocket if you needed it.
So you went over to Vietnam with the Army.
I went with Vietnam with the Army. My stepbrother went with the Navy, and he was shot down. We believe he was captured and died in captivity because one night in the middle of the night, my stepmother, his mother, woke up and said, "Marvin's dead." And it was just a psychic aspiration, and we never, he's still POW.
They've never found him?
No.
What's his name?
Marvin Giles.
How hard was that for you?
He was graduating from high school when I was in the sixth grade, so he was off to his Navy career. I got to meet him, make him angry several times. you know how little brothers can be.
I'm a little brother, I hear you.
Yeah. But he went off to Annapolis. That had a little bit to do with kind of, sort of, maybe coaching the congressman to make that appointment. Dad met the congressman when he was doing electrical work in his office and encouraged him. You know, you just don't get to Annapolis with straight A's. You've got to have more special talents than that.
So you're saying your dad hypnotized the congressman to get the appointment? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not admitting to anything.
It's time for another break. Today's program has taken a more circuitous route than most, but I think we're getting a little sense of the heartache this family has endured, from Chet losing all those shipmates when the Monson sank to losing his stepson in Vietnam. We've also gotten just a tiny glimpse of the exhilaration Chet felt when returning to Crystal Cave here in 2017. But when we come back, we're going to hear the whole story of how that unfolded and just how big of a challenge it was. Corey Thomason will give us his side of it. Then we'll hear from a junior college football coach and two of his players who rose to the occasion to help make this dream a reality. You'll find photos of their life-changing adventure at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.